Hello, and welcome to the July podcast with me, Harry Mount, editor of The Oldie, and the great Barry Cryer, who has been working in comedy since 1957, hero of I'm Sorry, Haven't a Clue, but most importantly, the best MC in the world for The Oldie Lunches. Barry, tell me about The Oldie Lunches. What is it you like doing them for? Because the pay isn't great.
Bottom line is, I'm a peopleaholic. And the people I've met at Oldie Lunches are just astonishing. The list, endless, politicians, show business people, just amazing authors and people I've sat chatting to, before the lunch. It's just been amazing.
And a great variety, isn't it?
Not terminally gregarious. Yeah. I love people.
And it's an extraordinary variety, as you say. It's politicians, it's showbiz, a few rogues in there as well.
Klaus von Bülow, as we speak.
Yes, the late Klaus von Bülow,
The legend, and of course, the Getty connection with the Oldie magazine. And Paul Getty Jr., wasn't it,
took over
the Oldie, and that great was the connection why Klaus von Bülow met. And I arrived one day with my wife at an Oldie lunch and was greeted by Klaus von Bülow. Hello, Barry. Who is this beautiful woman? And my wife went a bit weak at the knees and he got her a drink. And she said, who was that? I said, Klaus von Bülow. The knees buckled. David Cameron and his mother.
Oh, yes,
Oldie of the year.
Yep.
She denied it, but she alleged to have said Jeremy Corbyn should wear a tie and a suit and stand up for the national anthem. And my age, Harry, I don't really care. I think I'm always courteous. I'd never met David Cameron. And the place was buzzing before the lunch started. And I went over and tapped him on the shoulder. And he turned round, hello. And I said to him and his mother, will you keep the noise down? There's been complaints. She laughed. He looked utterly blank at me. He went, you know, it's... Was that a joke? It wasn't a great joke, but she got it.
She got it, he didn't.
I know, these moments are fascinating.
Barry, you have not only met everyone, you've worked with everyone, you've written for everyone from Morecambe and Wise to the Two Ronnies to Bob Hope. And I think you say to me that you don't think of yourself as a comedian, you think of yourself as a comic writer, is that correct?
Well, I spent my working life with comedians and these great men and women. The brilliant ones were originals. I'm not original. I tell stories and sing songs. And entertainer's a nice word, or raconteur. But no, I've great respect for comedians because it's a naked art. It's the only one where you go on and the audience sit there going, get on with it. It's the only one where if you disagree with somebody, don't analyse it. The show, the person they saw, I didn't think that was funny. Well, I did. Don't discuss it because it's one of those natural disagreements. You can't analyse it. You can analyse why you don't like a song or a play or a band or something. But if somebody doesn't find something funny, you will not convince them it is by analysing it. And the American, I've forgotten his name, has said analysing comedy is like dissecting a frog. Nobody laughs and the frog dies.
Having said that, in your fantastic book, the Barry Cryer Comedy Scrapbook, which I have in front of me, Michael Palin does a very good intro, and he says, you're the master of the punchline. What is the art of the ultimate punchline?
Oh dear, I don't know. I find myself a very boring topic, Harry. I don't know. You just love words, I suppose. If I've got any talent, it's making connections. So something happens, or somebody's there, a person, an incident, and I can make one or two connections. I think that's where the line comes from. It's like people say to me, I told one of your jokes last night. I say, they're not mine. You can only lease them. There's no copyright. I know none of us claim to have written the joke. This elephant went into a pub. No, we don't know where that came from. None of us claim to have written it. We write material. And I think jokes, something happened in real life and somebody... bright brain said that would be funnier if, and it grows organically. But jokes fascinate me because none of us wrote them. They're folklore. They're just fascinating. I wrote material. I'm basically known as a line man, and I hardly ever wrote alone. And I was very lucky because the writers I worked with, almost without exception, were better than me at construction, Graham Chapman, I wrote a lot with. John Cleese used to say to him, "Are you being unfaithful to me with Baz?" But Graham was very good at construction. What would happen next? If I had any talent, it was for the character and how they spoke.
Because you gave me a very good tip when I interviewed Dick Clement and Ian Lafrenier the other day. You said, ask which one does the typing and which one does the talking. And you were quite right. Dick Clement does the typing because he did it when he was at school, and Ian Lafrenier does the talking. But also, in terms of dividing up comedy, there's always one who's more original than the other, or there's one who, as you say, is doing character, or there are no real rules.
Well, it's there again. You can't analyse it. It's the chemistry. It either works for two people or it doesn't. The great Johnny Spate, who wrote Till Death and everything, and oh, brilliant writer, and he'd become a friend, but he was a soloist. He didn't write with anybody, but they got us together to write a one-hour special for Frankie Howard, Francis Howard in concert. And Johnny and I, he lived near me anyway, Johnny and I got together and talked and just laughed. We thought, this isn't going to work. We started trying to write together. We said, it isn't going to work. So now it'd be done with your computer too, but we wrote half the show each and got together and knocked it into shape, and we had a great time. But as I say, he was a soloist. He didn't write with anybody. But that was a real pleasure, because as I say, we did half each, bag it into shape, and that was good.
You also say in this great book, actually overheard lines from everyday people are often fantastic, some very good ones in the book. But, and Alan Bennett apparently actually sent people out on the street to overhear.
Oh.
People say funny things without realising, don't they?
Alan and I, to this day, we swap things we've overheard and everything. One of my favourites was two women. I spoke at an after dinner, and they said, "You live in Hatch End," which I do in Middlesex. They said, "We live in Ruislip. We'll give you a lift home tomorrow, so you can cancel your rail ticket or whatever." So I'm going back in the car with these two women, and one of them's chatting about her husband, who was a member of Round Table, and she said to her friend, Bruce, "He's towing a paper dragon down Ruislip High Street this afternoon." Her mate said, "How did he get stuck with that?" And she said quite seriously, "He's the only round tabler with a tow bar." And I thought, that is poetry. And I rang Alan Bennett, and he doesn't laugh, he groans. He went, oh, I'm having it. I'm having it. He said, "It's the only round tabler with a tow bar, isn't it?" It's just wonderful. It's real life.
Yeah.
And my wife and I were in our local Morrison's one day, and a couple of our generation walked past us, and she was almost skipping. And as they walked past, she said to her husband, "Only two more items, and they're quite small." And her husband said to me as he walked past, "The excitement builds." This is wonderful stuff. You couldn't write that. It's just a joy. And Alan and I swapped them.
And Barry, to go back to your childhood, your father sadly died when you were very young. Where did you think your funny side came from? Was he or your mother very funny?
I don't know. Well, I hardly knew my dad. I'm envious to this day when people talk about their father. I don't know whether... I discovered he was popular. I don't know whether he was funny. My mother had a very dry, deadpan wit. I don't know where it comes from in the genes, Harry, or the DNA. I don't know. I think I was a cliché at school. Try and make the bully laugh. I think that was my role. Did I tell you about... I'm going to name him on this podcast. There was... Oh, I've just forgotten his name now. Oh, Marshall Bellow. There's a name. And he used to whip us with wet towels and crush you in the tram going to the sports and the games. We all remembered him. Years later, through the Variety Club, I got warm greetings from Lord Bellow. I thought, if I ever meet you again, I'll be very courteous, but I'll be looking at you thinking, leopards don't change their spots. Are you bullying your employees these days? No, the bully. I think it's been my sort of role, I suppose. And I got an obsession, which stays with me to this day. I love trying, not always succeeding, trying to make people laugh, particularly somebody you've never seen. There's a man and a woman in my local pub, I won't name them, neither known for hardly smiling, never mind laughing. I've made both of them laugh at one point. I like a challenge, and it really gave me a kick when they suddenly laughed. And it's the worst ways of spending your life, aren't there, than trying to make people laugh?
Fantastic. And then in terms of your early career, you dropped out of Leeds University, is that right? And
they dropped me. I'm BA in Lit failed. I chased girls and I was in the bar. Yes, and I was a disgrace. And last year they made me Honorary Doctor of Arts.
That's the way to do it, yeah.
And I said, I'm a BA in Lit failed. They said, we don't care. So I addressed the throng at the Melvin Bragg, the Chancellor, presented me with it. And I was asked to speak, and I looked at all these people. I said, you're looking at a failure. Get your rejection over early. Rejection's good for you when you're young and you can cope, and you'll learn from it. Get it over early, which I did.
And then you went in, looking at your in this book, you went into comedy. Your first credit is in 1957 at the Windmill Club, the famous, what would you call it? It's not quite a strip joint, is it?
Oh, no. We have Windmill reunions, and these great women I work with of my age, they're looking wonderful. And they say, we were not strippers. They were nudes. It's another world, and they couldn't move. They posed nude on the stage, they couldn't move. And the great Vivian Van Damme, VD to us all, he and Mrs. Henderson, there's been a play and a film and everything about it, acquired this little theatre, and it wasn't doing well. And he or she or somebody said, nudes. And in those days, the Lord Chamberlain was in authority with the government, and he was informed they were going to do nudes, and he forbade it. And the great Van Damme got some reproductions of classic nude paintings, went to see Lord Chamberlain and showed him these famous paintings and said, this is what we're doing. You couldn't make it up. And Lord Chamberlain said, oh, very well. And they agreed. And that was the birth of the Windmill. We never closed. They were through the Blitz. And there again, the pun was, we never closed. But the theatre stayed open in the Blitz. The Windmill girls with tin helmets on were on the roof watching the searchlights and the bombs. And amazing era.
And in terms of what you're doing, I think you've said it was a really good training because you were doing constant, what was it, sketches, stand-up?
No, it was just, we didn't call it stand-up in those days, but I was bottom of the bill. Bruce Forsyth was top. I did my 12 minutes, six shows a day, 6 days a week, 36 shows a week. I can't believe it looking back. And you died. I mean, you died with dignity because they'd come in to see the nudes. And there was a great Geordie called Jimmy Edmondson who walked on the stage one afternoon, and a man in the front row opened a newspaper. And Jimmy said, oh, I see you brought your own comic. But you learned. It was a good training. It livened up later when you got ones who'd been to the pub. And, of course, if you bought a ticket, you could stay for all six shows. And if you ever left, people would climb over the seats to get to your seat nearer the front. There was an announcement. Patrons are requested not to climb over the seats, which was drowned by the sound of people climbing over the seats. Jimmy Edwards, great comic, referred to it as the Grand National. Artificial aids to vision are not permitted. And a man with sort of weird binocular glasses for use at race courses and whatever, he was wearing them. And the house manager, Tony, I think his name was, big man but very lovely guy, he would remove people who were misbehaving. And he was told about this man wearing binocular glasses. And he removed him quietly and politely. No, sir, not allowed. His feet hardly touched the floor, and he's still wearing the glasses. And you walk downstairs to get out of the Windmill, and he fell down the stairs and broke his leg. Oh, the stories at the mill were just amazing.
And then, Barry, through the in the introduction, I referred to this extraordinary roll call of comedians you've written for, from Morecambe and Wise, the two Ronnies, Bob Hope, Jack Benny. Were you writing, building up this roll call through the late 50s, 60s, 70s?
Did they get started in the 60s, I think, and through 70s and 80s. It was wonderful. But as I said before, I never wrote alone. So you were with a mate writing, and you met idols. Jack Benny was an absolute idol of mine, because I loved his slow style. And, of course, his image was the mean, conceited coward. And the loveliest, warm man when you met him. Remembered everybody's name. Little buzz you got when he'd come in a room and say, "Hello, Barry," and you'd, he said my name. I know that sounds pathetic, but he was a great comedian. But he evolved a style. He had to follow the Marx Brothers when he was a young comic. I always thought, when you were a young comic trying to make it your way, you can't have been slow like you are now. You'd have had to. But he told me, he decided early on, he followed a manic Marx Brothers sketch, clowning around the Great Grouch Show and all that. And he had to follow them in this vaudeville show or whatever. And he thought, "I'll be different." And he was slower and quieter, and the style evolved through the years. And I heard on digital radio, Radio 4 Extra, the Jack Benny radio show. It was superb, but no jokes. It was all embarrassment and timing, him on the radio. He was boasting to his friend Rochester. He was much admired, by the way. Rochester was black. His sidekick, Rochester, his friend, was black. And it sounds unbelievable now, but that was really something in those days. Star comedian. And he was boasting to Rochester when he got home. He'd given 50 cents to a beggar. And all you hear is the crash of the dishes when Rochester drops them at this information. And then Rochester says, "What do you say?" So Jack Benny repeats it. You hear further dishes crash. Superb radio. Later on, Jack Benny's telling somebody, I gave him 50 cents. You hear the dishes crash a third time. And Jack Benny says, "Rochester, stop it. I'm not even in the kitchen, I'm in bed. The dishes have done it themselves." Oh, superb radio.
Fantastic. And you wrote for the Oldie last year about Tony Hancock. Presumably some comedians are more dependent on writers than others. So I think you said that once Galton and Simpson were sacked,
yes,
by Tony Hancock, the material fell apart. Is that right?
Yes, indeed. Tony was... Here we go again on definition. I think Tony was a brilliant comic actor, really. More a comic actor, but he needed the text. And as you rightly said, when Ray and Alan, Galton Simpson, left, it really was. And it wasn't just ego. He got rid of Sid James and Hattie Jakes and Bill Kerr, the Australian, Kenneth Williams. But Tony thought, aren't I any good? Am I only good as a sort of double act with Kenneth Williams and Sid? And I've got to go off on my own and see if it works. And of course it didn't, which was very sad. He even went to Hollywood at one point and got a bit part in a film and got dropped from the film, I'm told. It's very sad.
And he died in 68, and at about that time, you need a degree in comedy studies to work out all the different people working together. So a lot of the future Pythons you work with,
yes.
You work with Marty Feldman, you've worked with David Frost. Do you think it was a sort of... bad phrase, but golden age, 60s, late 60s.
Frost, who I called a practicing catalyst. He brought people together. He put Graham Chapman and I together. We'd never thought of writing together. But the people you met working for David Frost, it was just amazing. As you said, Python before they were Python, the Goodies before they were the Goodies, great old professionals like Keith Waterhouse, who was an idol of mine, and I met him. And Dick Vosper, the American, who subsequently became a writing partner of mine. The galaxy of writers. There was a whole gang of us. It was a joy.
And the BBC is very crucial then, isn't it? Aren't they being very good and liberal with saying, just go off and write this show? Is that right then?
Yes. Well, I don't know whether other people got the license, but yes, Frosty really had his own little miniature empire. He was massive. I mean, what other TV host helped to bring down an American president, really? Got Richard Nixon to apologise to the American people. I mean, that was sold all over the world. And Frosty told me he had to finance that himself that weekend. Nobody else wanted to know. And Nixon obviously thought, I can eat this young Brit for breakfast. And, you know, David had this affable way of talking, and the voice never changed, but suddenly with a killer question in the same tone of voice. John Major said being interviewed by David Frost is like being in a warm bath but wait for the cold shower. Because the deadly question came in the same friendly voice. Do you think you should apologise to the American people? Wonderful. And he loved comics. And he loved traditional comics. Ted Ray, who I worked with, I was a sort of bridge generation. I worked with some of my idols, Ted Ray and Arthur Askey and those people, Max Miller, for God's sake. But Frosty really liked Ted Ray and had him more than once on his show. And only David Frost would do a joke when introducing Ted Ray. And I always remember one show. David Frost said, he's just been appearing as Buttons in Lord of the Flies. And before the audience could even laugh, Ted Ray said, I was looking for an opening, David. You know, those great comics, you fed them a line and they came straight back in.
And Barry, in 1972, the brilliant I'm Sorry I Haven't a Clue gets going. Did you realise at the time that there was something extraordinary to the show?
No, you didn't realize. When you're there, it's what I call the hindsight saga. You look back and you think, yeah, a bit of a breakthrough there. We knew we were having a good time. It's like when so-called alternative comedy erupted, Ben Elton and everything. You sort of felt there's something happening here, but Tommy Cooper and Eric and Ernie are still going, that's all right. But then you look back and you think, yeah, real watershed at times. That was the week that was on television and and Beyond the Fringe on the stage, of course. There was something happening when you look back. There was a lack of deference as well. No respect for authority, which had been done, incidentally, in the Goon Show on the radio. Spike Milligan, Mike Bentine and Harry Secombe had been in a war. Peter Sellers, no, he was the youngest.
Yeah.
So they could have been killed. So they came out of the war with no respect for authority. They'd been sent to kill each other. So they had no respect for the government or the BBC. So the Goon Show was our Monty Python, my generation.
And does that feed into Clue? Clue has a lot of sort of fantasy to it, doesn't it?
Well, the great Humphrey Littleton, who was our original chairman, and Jack Dee's brilliant now, but Humphrey Littleton said, never lose touch with silly. What I miss now, there's a lot of brilliant comedy now, but I miss silly. People just having fun. Eric and Ernie, Morecambe Wise and Tommy Cooper, they were grown adults behaving like children. I miss silly. Harry Hill does brilliant silly. He did a comedy capsule programme where people were just silly, and I do miss that. Just sheer fun. No darkness, no nuances, no... we're being silly here.
And also the power of character. You write in your book about some of the fantastic scenes in Dad's Army between Wilson and Mannering.
Oh, yes.
When you read the script, they're very plain, but because you know the characters,
yes,
it's incredibly funny.
Well, Mannering, our comedy, I'm generalising madly, our comedy, so much of the great comedy was about class. Dad's Army certainly was. I mean, Mannering's amazement discovering Wilson was a member of the golf club, which Mannering hadn't managed to join. And there's a wonderful Dad's Army where there's a do at the town hall or something, and Wilson, John the Measurer, is surrounded by people, a group of people, they're all laughing. Alone in the corner is Mannering, Arthur Lowe, with a drink, thinking, what is going on? I'm being ignored. And they're all talking to Wilson. Oh, it's just brilliant. Basil Fawlty was snob and got taken for a ride by a con man who pretended to be the Earl of something, didn't he, and ripped him off.
Yeah. Oh, all yes. All those figures, an aspiration going wrong.
And Rising Damp, which people don't mention enough. Eric Chappell, that's superb. Rigsby in there was desperate to make something of it. Steptoe and Son, Harold desperate to get out of there. Tony Hancock. They all aspire to get out, and you think you're not going to make it. One foot in the grave.
And it's brilliant writing. You make a point in your book that bits of Steptoe and Son are a bit like Samuel Beckett.
Yeah, a critic said that once, and I thought, oh, stop it, that's a bit. And I watched a Steptoe and Son one week, and I hardly laughed for half an hour, but I thought it was brilliant. And I thought, that's better than Beckett.
I saw an early Harold Pinter sketch the other day, which is very like the famous Four Candles, Four Candles sketch.
Yes. Pinter admired comedians, apparently, I've discovered. I'm not surprised, because he had a way with the line and everything, and the timing and the great pauses. But apparently he admired comedians very much.
And Barry, in your book, you're very wary of the cliché about comedians having a dark side, and you're very funny about some wicked interviewer like me trying to find a dark side to Les Dawson.
Yes.
And that's a terrible cliché, and not really true. Some non-comedians have dark sides too, don't they?
Yes. Well, Les was virtually indistinguishable. We all liked Les, and he made you laugh, and he was the same off stage as on. What went... any sadness of what went on behind closed doors, you respected. But there was no... You know, and as I said in that interview, the woman in desperation to finish said, was there a Les Dawson nobody ever saw? And I said, if there was, nobody ever saw him. Yeah, it's interesting. Dear Tony Hancock, of course, the great Spike Milligan, manic depressive and, you know... One day you'd be laughing with Spike, and the next day he's staring at the wall saying, how can we bring children into this fucking world, you know? So that up and down, but you can, all generalisations are untrue.
But also, this may be the kiss of death, Michael Palin, the king of nice, yes, says one of the keys to you is that you're extremely nice. And you, how have you avoided the pitfalls of fame? You haven't become an alcoholic or unpleasant.
I'm not famous. No, I'm a peripheral figure. Ronnie Corbett, my old friend, said, I'm always Baz. I don't know what rung of the ladder you're on, Baz, but stay there. He said, you're always around and nobody's pointing at you. No, I don't regard myself. No, I don't want to be a celebrity, for heaven's sake. No, I'm around. I'm one of the gang or on the sidelines.
Well, Barry, that's a very good place to spot, not least because the punters are pouring in for the oldie lunch. So I'm so grateful to the great Barry Cryer for appearing on the July podcast for the oldie. Thanks so much, Barry.
It's been a pleasure. Same time tomorrow.